and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most revived work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord. Huzzah!
Huzzah! Before we get into the chapter, quick reminder, the fan art contest is currently on. It's due May 5th, so you've got about 2 weeks left to submit your artistic masterpiece. We've got two already. Both pale themed, which is very exciting, but you know, don't forget there's parahumans, there's twig, there's poke. So you know, hit us up with your best stuff.
Yeah, what you're most keen on the poke fan art, is that right, Elliot?
I mean, admittedly, I'm kind of biased, but yes.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I forgot to say the theme is till death do us part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that definitely applies pretty well for poke.
Yes. Also, a quick heads up that in 2 weeks we'll be doing a sort of special episode recording to celebrate the 3-year anniversary of Pale, as well as the fact that we're going to be taking a quick break right after that point. So there'll be more details in next week, but if you're not already in the Discord, that's where that's all going to be, because the time for our recording will change for the anniversary, and that's where all the details on the interactive stuff will be. So join the Discord if you're at all interested in stopping by for that special recording.
Yes, so you can head to doofmedia.com/discord and yeah, that'll get you the info you need.
Yeah.
But let's get into the episode, shall we, Elliot? This week's chapter 23.z is the final chapter of Go for the Throat? I mean, probably, right?
We're recording our reflecting episode immediately after this. Yep. So I don't know when the next chapter will come out, but if it's not 24.a or 1, then we're going to be pretty embarrassed.
23.z2.
Yeah. I feel like the Z is a sign.
Probably the final chapter. Yeah. The final chapter of Go for the Throat. It's definitely got a finality feel to it because, we get some pretty bonkers stuff happening.
Well, I don't. It's interesting because you said it's got like an ending vibe to it. And I think there's some really fun discussions around the concept of endings in this chapter. So
yeah,
yes, but also no. That's going to be a really interesting thing to talk about. I mean, the summary of this chapter in my head is this is the chapter where we learn that the Fae Courts, much like the end of Pale, don't really exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But before we get to all that, we're with Avery. She is just kind of taking stock of the situation here as Castleberry is ripping into some enemies before making a quick phone call to Y.
And wait, holy shit, Castleberry is a fucking beast. Like,
yeah.
He just, it's like him against a bunch of boogeymen and goblins, and he's winning so hard to the point that the goblins start actively avoiding him. It's so funny. Like, Mrs. Schaff is going to be so OP once she figures out how to wrangle these kitties.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of conversation about how bringing in Castleberry actually might have been more trouble than it was worth. is pretty wild considering the dire straits they were in.
I love Blank Shanks's whole thing on that. I want to talk about it later for sure. But just Mrs. Schaff's whole vibe of like, I love the bit where Verona is like, oh, Mrs. Schaff, we're going to go out there and set your cat on fire, which like in my head, I read it like she had this tone of like the vet being like, you know, we're going to need to anesthetize your cat or whatever.
Yeah, by lighting it on fire.
Yeah.
The world's worst vet.
But not in this case. Like, and I love that Mrs. Schaff is like, okay. And like her whole vibe of like, she's like cradling him later and her whole thing was like, I thought I was nursing him back to health. And it's like, what do you think this thing is? Like,
pretty funny.
And I mean, I also love how like it really sort of sets a harsh tone for this chapter that like we open and Castleberry is literally digging into boogeymen and ripping out them out and like mungling their corpses. And then it like the narration cuts to Avery and it's like Avery sitting there on her phone and her legs bouncing, like it's like she's just kind of watching this and is a bit bored.
I mean, your life must be pretty funny when this can end up making you bored.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's something this part of the chapter hits pretty hard, is like where the Kennedys are mentally. But it's like, it's just funny that like Avery's kind of watching this and just, it's not phasing her in the slightest.
Mm, yeah. Good times for Avery. The thing that is phasing her, which I think is good, is that the murder of the family man is still playing on her mind a bit. But not so much that it's like you know, fucking her up, which I think is good. Like, I think it feels like it's the perfect amount of weighing on their mind for having done a justified required murder. I think it's, I'm just kind of like, yeah, good work, Avery. You're not being too fucked up by this, but you're not like ignoring it, or, you know, think it's
well,
good.
Yeah, like I agree. I was kind of in 100% agreement with Melissa's take on this, where Melissa was like, you killed a guy, that's pretty intense. And Avery's like, yeah. And it's like, but he was with the guys that killed Mal. Mm. And Avery's like, yeah. And Melissa's like, I got you back then. Let's like, you know, justified. And I was like, yeah, like, yeah. It's fucked up that Avery just straight up killed a guy. But also that guy was the family man. So like, could be worse. but I mean, I think it is like the fun angle of how it's getting to Avery. Like she brings it up with Liberty later is what is freaking Avery out is the fact that she doesn't really feel bad about it. Like, and this, like, I remember Ward addressed this a lot too, and Pale's dabbled in it a bit as well. But yeah, like what's kind of freaking Avery out is it's like, she just did a murder and she's fine with it. And that's not a spot you want to be in. Like we've been recording for our we've been preparing for our arc 23 reflecting episode, which we're doing right after this. So like I've been reviewing what happened at the start of the arc, and like obviously this is the chapter that we think is rounding out this arc, and this arc was the one that started with the parents having that chat about the girls, and you know, Jasmine had all that stuff. They're worried about what this war is doing to their daughters, and I think that's the big thing that carries this opening Avery segment, is like there's a heavy presence of Avery just did a murder and she doesn't feel bad about it, and that's kind of freaking her out. We've also got Lucy, who has a giant wound on her neck that she's kept hidden from Jasmine, and she's just letting Jasmine take care of the little wound she's got and hiding the big one. Like there's some deception there. There's this whole bit with Lucy and Wallace where Wallace tries to talk about their sort of breakup, and Lucy's just like, I literally don't care right now. which was hilarious, but also like I think if we go back to the start of this arc where the parents are like, we're worried about what this war is doing to the mental state of our daughters, the start of this chapter is very much like they were right to be worried. All three, and like, you know, Verona's off processing the death of her friends. Like all three of them are not in a good mental place right now.
Should we touch on the bit? I mean, I don't know if you've talked about it in your notes. I think it's a little bit later, but there is a bit where Jasmine is like, this, you had one more fight and this was it, so you're done. And when I was reading that, I was like, oh, no, that can't be right. And it isn't. Like, you know, they clearly the feeling of this fight is not that it's the final fight. But like, it's so funny to me thinking about it from Jasmine's perspective of like, oh, yeah, I mean, kind of that makes sense.
And especially Jasmine's banging that call without seemingly even knowing that Lucy's hiding the bigger wound on her neck. Like, it's hard not to think Jasmine's kind of on the money. I agree. I think that moment is really fun for kind of reminding us that these stakes are here. Like, the parents are against this war. And again, as you said, as this section is reminding us, all three Kenneteers are kind of fucked up right now. Like, it's hard not to feel like Jasmine's really got a point.
Yeah.
There is some nice bits that contrast it, though. Like, there's the bit, like, so Verona walks off to sort of be by herself for a bit, and Jasmine gets worried by that, and Lucy is like, no, like, this is what Verona needs right now. She just needs time. She'll either process it, or she's going to come back with a crazy plan, and it ends up being that she's kind of done a bit of processing, which Avery's thrilled about, but it's like, it's that thing, like, not giving Verona time to sit and process was what caused Lucy and Verona to have all those fights right before summer break. Like, it's this moment of like positive growth for the Kenneteers that Lucy knows what Verona needs and is able to give her that space and communicate to her mum that Verona needs that space. So like, I like that the story is kind of doing both. It's not like, like this section is filled with alarming, like, warning signs that the Kenneteers are becoming grizzled soldiers and that sucks, but then also they're really good at caring for each other and they work well together, and like, it can be both.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's really true. We kind of, the story is giving both sides of that argument. I think it's going to be really fun to see where that goes next arc. I also wanted to give a quick shout out to the fact that Melissa is back to being called Melissa and not Oakham now that Mal is gone.
Sad.
I mean, part of that could be that it's Avery's POV and she wasn't really around for the whole Oakham thing quite as much, but I like the idea that it's because Mal's gone, because that's really sad.
Yeah, pretty rough.
The other thing, so we're about to jump to the second POV for the chapter two. Yeah. And I just want to call out, there were some evil section breaks in this chapter. Like, I don't know if other people ran into this read, but like, I was livid every time we'd cut out of a POV. Like, Avery would start calling Y and she'd be like, I need to call in a favor. And then we cut to Marcy and I was like, fuck. And then Marcy drops a bombshell and we cut back to Avery and I was like, fuck. And then Avery starts talking to Florin and then we cut back to Marcy and I was like, fuck. Like, it was like reading Pact again. It was just like every bit was ending on this cliffhanger that I was like, I don't want to leave this right now. It was great.
And we skip over the actual conversations with these people to a large extent.
Oh, it's so I know. Sad. Yeah. It was evil. I loved it.
But yeah, so the other perspective that we're jumping to for the majority of this chapter is Marisica. And yeah, I mean, we're getting the last chapter ended with Charles saying, let Marcy have the moment she's been waiting for so long. And she finally does. before then, I guess, is her arguing the Wild Hunt for a bit. And then the consort arriving with her brother in tow, who was, she thought was all, not thought was, but was meant to think was dead, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot here.
It took me a few reads to understand everything that was going on, to be honest.
Yeah, fucking Faye. You're right, though. Like, the moment the consort shows up was sort of the moment where it's like, okay, 100% some bonkers shit is about to happen, yeah. Right? Because, like, yeah. Wait, the consort, we haven't seen her since the flashbacks in 11.z, Marcy's other interlude. It's like, yeah. The second she came on, I was like, this is about to pop off. Like, the hype levels when the consort appears were astronomical.
Yeah, pretty wild. But also hard to keep track of. Well, I mean, at the start it's okay. Marcy's talking to the Wild Hunt and then plans to make a big box, you know, classic stuff. And then the consort arrives with Brizoban, her brother, and things really start to pop off from there, I guess.
Yeah, but like, to focus on the bit before even the consort shows up, I loved how, like, Marcy and the Wild Hunt are trading verbal barbs as they're fighting.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of peak, like, soap opera-y Faye bullshit. Like, they're just constantly, like, everyone's like, oh, but it's this. Oh, no, but it's this. Like, you know, oh, blood is my thing. It's like, oh, well, we don't have wounds. And, it was so silly. And
it's like, you know that game that you play when you're in primary school where you just have to come up with a counter to what your opponent does?
Yeah. You know? And I thought that was really fun because it got me to, like, lower my guard for the actually really great Faye bullshit that's going to come up later in the chapter. Like, we kind of opened with the dorkiest Faye stuff, which made me forget how serious Faye can be. So I thought that was funny. And it also very much reminded me Marcy has this bit of fairy still inside of her, which will become important later on.
Yes.
But also just like, I just got to call out, Marisica knows the names of a lot of the members of the Hunt and she starts talking about them. And there's one that's called Macbeth. And I just, like, these guys, they're so goofy. Like, the Wild Hunt takes themselves so seriously.
They're so,
like,
silly in general, aren't they?
Especially because I was like, because that guy has to have been playing off Macbeth. But, like, Mag isn't a prefix, right? Like, Mac is, you can be Mac or Maccas. You can't be, like, Mags. Like,
these guys are just. What's the point you're trying to make here?
It's just a dorky name.
It is a dorky name, that's true. I think it's really funny to think about, like, conceptually, that all the Fae that we really know well are, like, Fae exile Fae.
Mm.
It's just funny to me to think about the concept that, like, Fae, it's, for some reason, the Fae get exiled, you know, and then those are the characters that we usually come to know because the other Fae are just kind of off doing their own crazy shit. Like, man, Faye, such a weird structure.
Well, we'll get to talk about that a lot, because there's a bit of a shake up coming there for them.
Well, yeah.
In a very fun way. Because yeah, I completely agree. There's a difference in the Fae that we see who have been exiled to the human realm, and that's going to be a thing. Yeah. Going forward. I also, there's a great moment here where Marisica thinks to herself, like, she could turn her wounds into a kind of advantage. Like, you're making a blood goddess bleed. That's as foolish as waging a war against a Carmine judge. Mm. And I love that line. Like, it really jumps out to you on the second read, because the Wild Hunt are kind of setting her up at this point still. Like, Guillaume's going to make his move later. Like, they know what's happening. And they're setting her up to be poisoned, which is a great way to kill a blood goddess, because you poison the blood. Like, I love that. And Marisica has made this call out that she's like, it's as foolish as waging war against the Carmine judge. And it's like, that's kind of what's happening to Charles as well, right? Like, this war is going on here at the Blue Heron Institute, but that's just the distraction so the Kenneteers can do their, like, bring everyone into awareness plan. Like,
yeah, it's a good point.
Like, the making Marisica bleed and the waging the war on the Carmine judge, that's just the thing everyone's doing to them so that they think everything's going fine.
Yeah, you're right. That's a really good thing to point out. Marcy is too sure of herself.
Yeah. Oh, shit. And before we move on from this section, we've got a guy. So Brooke and Hollow Yen are just fucking drinking tea on the sidelines. Yeah. This is the funniest shit.
Doesn't Rook even say, we're not going to do anything else today, we've already done our part or something, right?
But Marisica says they've done their part, they're not going to do anything. Yeah, but it's Marisica who thinks it. Yeah, but like, okay. Which is, yeah, I think I do want to get into a set, but we can't move past the hilarious image of all this fable shit going on, and like, Rook has just busted out the fine china and she's just enjoying the show, like, you know, calling out these guys for being dorky soap opera people at times, like, Rook is here for her stories, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, because they don't get called out. Wait. I assume she was just watching the whole time, like, until Marisica got put in the box. There's no indication that Rook and Hollow Yen left. So, I think she was just enjoying the show. At a way, in terms of, you know, Rook's all about being in position and stuff. I think this is her personal best for a fun position to be in. Just watching Fae courts get upended, off to the side drinking your tea, best position in the world. Like, it's all downhill from here for Rook.
Yeah. Thank God. Fuck Rook. I'm sick of Rook just sitting off to the side. Whichever side she's on now, I'm over her, you know?
It's going to be so interesting to see where this whole thing lands with Rook, because I'm just kind of like, you're gonna have to make a fucking hell of a case for being on Team Goody. Yeah.
The tinfoil everyone's saying is that she's gonna fuck with the Kims, right? Like, I can see that.
Yeah.
But even so, I'm kind of like, don't think it's enough, Rook. I don't think it's enough.
It's gonna have to be a big move for it not to feel too little too late, whatever she does. And yeah, we do get this seed planted, where it's Charles, she says that they've done everything they would tonight. So that's interesting. Like, what have they done? There was that talk earlier in the arc of somebody advocating for an anti-domain. Mm. Is that related to it? Rook and Hollow Yen are not listed in, when Charles meets with all his allies at the end of the chapter, they're not listed, but maybe that's because they're done for the night. You know, they clocked out early. Like, yeah. Just as always, when Rook comes up, I guess we'll see.
Mm, yeah.
But yeah, just props for sitting on the sidelines of Fae upheaval drinking tea. I think she won me over a lot with that image. That's so good.
Mm, yeah, fair enough. But yeah, so turns out Marcy knew her brother was alive and interpreted a signal that she was to be part of a wider upheaval, which is the removal of the Fae courts.
Yeah, I think we'll be talking about this for a while because there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, so let's just start with the what actually happened, right? So her brother, Brizaban, sent a messenger to a bunch of Fae exile to kind of keep tabs on the Fae that are closest to humanity as part of this bigger plot to invert the system so that these Fae exile who kind of know a bit more about humanity can kind of play their role within it, right? But the messenger that was sent to Guillaume was timed to be on the same night that Charles took over the Carmine throne, which was like
I think it was the messenger was the night the Carmine beast died.
Was it? I think it was whatever.
No. Yeah. I think I mean, it doesn't matter too much really, but I think it was the night the Carmine Beast died.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But whatever. Either way, yeah. It was kind of an indication that there's like, this is about subversion of systems on a larger scale. So Marcy kind of interpreted what the play was from that.
Mm.
And she's just kind of playing her part in it here, which kind of gives what she's doing a bigger sense of legitimacy, I guess, that lets her rally, you know, like the hand of the consort and the Wild Hunt and folks to that cause, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah. I think my understanding is Brisbane didn't really know where Mariska and stuff was, and he couldn't because the consort was tracking that shit. So he just sent these messengers to all the exiles, and it's like that message, you know, like the gaps in the message that Marcy could read. So it was like if she hadn't been there, that person still showing up would have been like a thing for any Fae exile, but extra specifically the one that went to Marcy was like she could see extra messages, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you this then. How did Brisbane know to send the messenger on the right night? That's the part that confused me.
Fairy. You know, sure. It's face shit. Enough. Face shit. But yeah, so this is fun as well because it's not, like, we always knew Marcy was kind of in burn it down mode, but I love that her and Brisbane's thing is like, yeah, they're not just overhauling the courts. And I love, like, Mariska specifically calls this out. It's like, the courts keep changing. There's a stability. Like, the consort has seemingly survived a bunch of these court overhauls. Like, you know, the fairy are acting like this is a big change in the story and it's a big deal. But there is a stability to what keeps happening when the courts change. And so Mariska and Brizzo are kind of like, nah, this is a cheap trick. This is boring. It's been done before. We're going to like really change the system. And they seem to think that what they're doing is genuinely new. And it's like, that's really exciting. They're not overhauling the courts. They're obliterating them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, some interesting tidbit is that we learn the Fae courts are actually very recent, although they've got a bit of a, the whatever it is in 1984, you know, the East and the West have always been at war kind of vibes.
Yeah, we've always been at war with East Asia. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, like, man, the Fae fucking losers, all of them, every single one of them.
So let's talk about that point, like, because I had certainly fallen for the trick. I thought that the courts had last changed hundreds of years ago was the vibe I had. I've been working on, like, I think I've talked about this not in the episodes, but during like the live recording bits that aren't in the episodes, but I've been working on like a document that kind of summarizes, you know, the sort of all my thoughts about the Otherverse, like a kind of grand universal theory of what everything in the Otherverse is. And I had this big section on the fairy courts that I wrote like 2 weeks ago, where I kind of was like, this is what all the fairy courts represent. This is why they put together the way they are, blah, blah. And I just had to fucking delete it after reading this chapter. I was so mad. It was so funny.
Mm.
And like, it, like, that's exactly what has sort of happened in universe. Like, I don't know if you remember the 5.2 extra material, which is the one Avery did that goes over all the fairy courts. Mm. But I'm only familiar with it because I was writing up a thing about the fairy courts a couple of weeks ago. But that's also the one. Avery does all the fairy courts, and then she tries to do the goblin system, and she it ends with her being like, oh, there is no system. This was all pointless. I've wasted my time on this.
Yeah.
And we thought she was just talking about the goblin part, but, like, that applies to the whole document. It is all just bullshit. It doesn't make sense. She wasted her time trying to learn the courts. It's nonsense.
It is all bullshit, but that's what the Fae revel in. To them, that's not a detriment, I guess.
But I'm just amazed.
Goblins, like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, yeah, but the way the EM is built, I think this is a joke Wildbow has been sitting on for like 2.5 years, like, because, like, which is amazing. Like, you got to admire that sort of confidence and patience to be able to sit on that. Because, yeah, the 5.2 EM reads completely differently once you know that the Fae courts are just as bullshit as all the goblin structures.
Yeah. I guess it's just that the goblins don't believe their own bullshit, and the Fae do.
Yeah, pretty much.
Give it a sense of legitimacy.
The goblins are honest about their bullshit being bullshit, whereas the Fae pretend that it's real.
Mm.
And I do think, like, it is funny to think about as we enter this courtless system what this means for Toadie's whole idea, because obviously he's not trying to make the Eighth Court anymore. But I think Toadslaw is like 50, so he must be aware that the court's changed. So I don't think this is going to like rock his boat too much to not be the Eighth Court, but to be still the opposite of Winter. But I think it's going to be really fun to see how the Eighth Court concept changes now that it's only opposite Winter, I guess. Because Winter is going to shift a little bit, it seems. So, yeah, that's going to be really fun. It just makes the whole... So much of the stuff with the Wild Hunt and Winter is all like, everything's perfect and you can't threaten the system and it's always like this, blah, blah, blah. This just makes the Wild Hunt and Winter such losers that they've been guarding this whole court system. They're all older then. Like, they're so stupid. Like, Winter's such a joke. Come at me, Guillemet.
Yeah.
Like they're guarding the legacy and honor of something that isn't even really real. Like, they're like Star Wars fans.
good one. Get them, burn them. Yeah, this to me just really landed how silly the Fae are.
Yeah,
they're so silly. Fucking hell. Yeah.
So I guess like. I also love to think, so like part of what I was thinking about with the fairy courts a couple of weeks ago that I'm still kind of holding on to is like the more symbolic stuff around this. Like fairy are in this universe, I think, a lot about like they're the embodiments of not necessarily just story, but the stories about humans. Like they're social, interpersonal sort of stories. So it's really fun to think about what this changing of the courts stuff is emblematic of in the human world, I guess. Like, does the courts changing kind of map to changes in what's popular in stories? Like, you know, I'm thinking, does the court change like a decade ago? Did that maybe kind of align with the shift to online streaming and the golden age of TV? Like, as human tastes in stories change, the courts change with them. And then, like, what does it mean now that the courts are being obliterated for what the concept of stories are? Like, the fact that all the Fae are maybe going to get exiled and be directly in contact with humans, is that some sort of analog for how, like, you know, now authors are on Twitter and you can interact directly with an author? Like there's presumably, Wobba's usually cooking some fun symbolism behind this stuff, and I can't wait to see what that is.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, very, you know, interesting. Those elves who sit in their cabins and write for years and years without interacting with anyone, are they going to have to emerge a bit more now? Like,
they're going to have to get Twitter accounts, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, it's, I do think, like, as will always be a part of this story or this universe, the world changes so rapidly nowadays. It's like there's always going to be major upheavals because we just are in kind of that time technologically now. It's
yeah,
wild.
And I think it's gonna be really fun to track as this evolves throughout the franchise's life, like, well, the family, like, how that sort of, I'm assuming it maps to stuff relating to, yeah, like what Fae stories mean, and like how humans interact with stories. So it's going to be really fun to see what this means, sort of metatextually.
Yeah.
I also think it's worth talking about the fun parallels between Marisica's ultimate plan and the Kenneteer's one. Because, like, we learn the details of the Kenneteer's plan in this chapter, and, you know, it's all about sort of bringing equality and communal responsibility to awareness, which is, you know, very canon. I can't wait to talk about that when it comes up. But, like, Marisica and Brizzo's plan is in many ways the same, because, like, I don't hate this idea of integrating the Fae into human stuff, because, like, it seems like the Fae become their worst when they're isolated in the Fae realm and, like, become the most extreme versions of Fae shit. And, like,
yes,
it's going to be tumultuous and they're an evil Fae. Like, it's not going to be a clean transition, but, like, ultimately it's hard not to see this as a mostly positive thing, that Fae are going to have to interact with humans more.
Well, I kind of got the vibe that they were, I don't know, that it's like, yes, we will interact with humans, but as, you know.
Oh, as Fae, I mean, yeah.
Or whatever, right? Like,
well, oh no, when she said, like, lords, and, like, I think she was talking about, like, Fae lords, so it's kind of like the Fae, because the Fae lords are the ones who are the best at the current system, and so her and Brizzo are flipping the script, so it's the ones who are best with humans that will now be the best at the system and become the lords of the Fae. But like there's just definitely some strong parallels between what Mariska and stuff are doing here with integrating the Fae into society and what the Kenneteers are trying to do by make everyone woke and aware. So I think that's going to be another fun sort of through line to track going forward is what Mariska's done is bloody and like a terrible way of doing it, but she's kind of aimed for some of the same stuff as the Kenneteers.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think it is really interesting because like all of the conspirators, their plan has been different. Like, you know, everyone the Kenneteers have fought has had a different version of their plan.
yeah, like it's been a bit of a narcissism of small differences throughout this story, really. It's just those small differences tend to be quite massive. But yeah, like Mariska's idea in a lot of ways is also going for the throat, right? Like the Kenneteers have gone for the throat and that they're trying to connect everyone and enmesh them with this awareness pyramid scheme they're cooking up. And yeah, Mariska's kind of doing the same. She's forcing the Fae to socialize with humans. And it's going to suck, but also I can't help but be like, yeah, I don't think isolation was good for them either. So yeah, like I think that's super. And like this changes a lot, like because we used to talk a lot about Mariska being the Verona analog out of the culprits because she was the one who was trying to change herself to a different kind of other. And, you know, she was the worst kind of Verona because she was just kind of selfishly pursuing her own ends. And in this chapter, we actually learn that Reed was kind of dumb bullshit and we were wrong because she was doing all of this with her brother. Like this was coming from a social place of love and, you know, like, again, she's doing it in the bloodiest, most awfulest way possible. But this was a scheme to upend a corrupt system. She was part of a team. She did this transformation to herself kind of with her brother in mind. Like it's all of that stuff that connected Barcy to old worst case Verona has kind of evaporated once we've seen it in action. That's really fun.
Yeah.
Sorry. Also, I need to say it, but like the idea of all the Fae getting kicked out of the Fae courts and stuff just does remind me of when all the angels got kicked out of heaven in Supernatural. And I hate that I have to insult Wildbo by making that comparison, but it's right there.
Can we talk about Supernatural for a second? I've been seeing ads for Supernatural on 9 Now, I think it's called, which is one of the free-to-air channels here in Australia, their kind of streaming platform. And the ad is like, come join the two hottest monster hunters or something like that. Like it's very like focused on the attractiveness of Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki, which is, I mean, Jensen Ackles is an incredibly attractive man, but it's just so funny to me that that's the lens. Like it's so clear. It's like,
it's so Channel 9, like 7, 9 and 10 are all such a dog shit channels. Like I feel stupider every time I go to my parents' place and have to watch some.
Yikes.
Apologies to everyone for having to hear that, but it just because like the thing with Supernatural for me, right, is what I loved about watching Supernatural was that feeling of squandered promise, right? Like Supernatural had great ideas and then they completely flubbed the execution, and I was kind of unhealthily addicted to that cycle.
Yeah.
And what's great, and I remember talking about this early in Deep Impact, is what I've always loved about the other verse is it's kind of the opposite. Wildbo tends to have these promises and then actually kind of execute them.
This
is one of the biggest disappointments in Supernatural to me was the angel exodus from heaven, and we're going to kind of hopefully get to see the good version of this now in the other verse.
Well, I don't know. Probably not this story, based on the way this chapter ends, right? Like, it sounds like at the end, Guillaume is like, oh, this will probably still happen in a while, but you won't be around to see it kind of vibes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but, you know, fool me 100 times in terms of that's not in the scope of payoff.
Sure. No, but I was thinking about this, like, it sounds really interesting, especially if, you know, Kennet or not Kennet, but like East Canada is kind of the seed for the Fae integrating more with humanity. It sets up this interesting conflict as well with the Red Cap Queen, who feels like she'll be a part of
Oh, yeah.
Kind of the Pyre narrative. So I don't know. Sounds fun.
Yeah, I think we've done most of our Pyre talk behind Back to Pact's curtain.
Yeah.
So I don't want to talk about it too much here because I don't know how to separate what most people listening to this have heard. But like,
yeah,
I think both of us must be feeling pretty good about our Pyre-related predictions after seeing what's just happened with Marisica. Because this feels like it's heading in the directions we've talked about, which is exciting. Mm. Yeah, I can't wait. The Pyre hype is real in this, which, you know, again, maybe it is in Pale. We'll fucking see. Mm. What do you think? Sorry, what do you think the scope of this is? Like, in terms of the idea of the Fae getting completely emptied out, is that a global thing? Is that just North America? Like, I wonder how far reaching this is meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely get the sense that it's like,
it's at least, you know,
in the same
America,
way Charles
right?
is talking about, these are plans to be wide things that affect the entire world, but they always have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah. So yeah, we jump back to Avery. So yeah, I mean, the end of this section is like, oh shit, Marcy's doing it. The Wild Hunt have left at the end of this, as far as we know, I guess. But anyway, so yeah, Avery continues to make calls. She calls up Liberty to get a bit of personal rejuvenation / goblins foot soldiers. and then off to Mr. Knox's house.
And it's worth calling out, we did skip over, there's a little brief interlude where she calls Florin, which I'm surprised you skipped over that because I feel like everyone has been waiting for the Florin favor to be called in for years. And she's finally done it, and we don't know exactly what she's asked him to do. I mean, presumably it relates to the awareness pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like again, another one of those moments, 23.z is really hitting you with the like, all the chips are kind of falling down vibes. But yeah, so and then I guess getting to Liberty. Liberty's just such great entertainment. You can see how good she is as a choice by Avery for this kind of like less serious kind of pick me up that Avery needs. Like, Liberty makes this comment that murder is heavy, whereas Avery has a very light vibe, which I particularly love because we keep hearing how people who are like closer to the paths are literally lighter, like they don't weigh as much. And I never really made that wordplay connection before, but yeah, it's like the paths are light in the sense that they're not as heavy, and like that's Avery's vibe too, and like murder is just not her thing. And so I loved that little note from Liberty.
So Melissa, George, and Mia all come on this field trip to Mr. Knox's house, which I think is really interesting. Like,
yeah,
and kind of emblematic of the Kenneteers in that they're awareening these folks, but not so they can be kind of batteries or whatever like a Bristow might do, but in a way that is actually designed to give them agency and have them opt into things if they want to. And I think that's classic Kenneteer.
Yeah, you're right. I think agency being the key word there. It's like they're sort of like, can we come? And the girls are like, yeah. And like Melissa has that moment where she's like, this is where they say no. And then they're like, yeah, sure. And it's like, that's a part for Melissa where Melissa's a bit like, oh, this is different now. I also think to complement what you just said, what I really like is that it's another example of Avery making people aware and then immediately taking them to some crazy path that's, you know, reasonably chill. Like, I love that that's becoming part of the Kenneteer staple as well, which is make someone aware and then introduce them to the paths, which I think is a great way of showing you some fucking magic. But also, like, the paths are the part of this world that's, like, you know, like, whimsically magical. Like, you know, so much of the magic in this world is like, oh, fuck, that's horrifying. Whereas, like, the paths are kind of horrifying, but the paths are also the part that's like, oh, this is the magic in stories I read as a kid. Like, this is funny and random and whimsical. And, like, I love that the Kenneteers are sort of seemingly not even on purpose, but just kind of, like, awareing people and then instantly showing them this part of the magic system that's, like, the fun part of magic, really.
I really love this bit where Mr. Knox goes, he looked George up and down. I have a new question. For me? George asked. No. It's just very silly. It just made me laugh a lot that George was like, my time to shine.
Yeah, he was so excited to contribute, but he cannot. And yeah, and so this is where we get the details on the awareing plan, as Avery finally explains it to Mr. Knox on screen. And yeah, I mean, obviously, it's great. I fucking love it. It's this classic Kennett community vibe of like directly countering the worst parts of the SEAL, like the way everyone's going to share responsibility for bad things happening to aware. It's like this. Like, I remember we had tons of discussions when we're talking about like the Knights, got Millie's family, and it was like, yeah, practitioners were meant to be protecting innocence, but they distanced themselves from actually doing that. And this forces them not to be able to do that. It's like, now if an aware gets picked on, everyone in this unit is kind of going like on the hook a little bit for that. So it directly encourages the practitioners to actually be doing their job of protecting the people who need protecting. Like,
yeah,
that is the major problem that the current manifestation of the SEAL has, and they're directly addressing that. Like, I love this. It's so perfectly Kennett and Kennetier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty strong as a move for sure.
Yeah, like it gives people the agency you're talking about with the awareness. It also, yeah, puts practitioners on the hook to actually do their job of tapering out the worst of the others. It's so good. And it's just unfortunate that, as Mr. Knox brings up, this is the fucking worst time to do this, because Charles has just covered the whole fucking province in violent others who will attack New Aware.
Yeah, and that's the issue that is raised is,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, Knox says, can you get your people attacking Charles to convince him to stop doing that? Like, no, they of course he's going to keep doing that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's going to be the fun part of Arc 24, right, is that Charles, whether on purpose or not, has created the perfect counter to what the Kennetiers' current plan is, and they're going to have to figure out how to address that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing I love about this this network that they're creating, like the Aware Pyramid Scheme, again, it feels like it addresses exactly the problem with Bristow's network that they had, where like the big issue with Bristow's network was kind of deciding who has responsibilities and stuff. And now it is just like people who are making others aware, like kind of have to be on the hook for them, and it's proximity based. So like people in big cities will kind of have responsibility to protect them. Like it's just, it's good. I can't also help but think, though, say they get past Charles and they do this awareing plan, and the way they specifically call out practices empowered directly by the SEAL will be hit the hardest, which includes Charles. So that's nice. But like people like London and shit are going to hate this, right? Like the rest of the world is extremely pro SEAL. I mean, obviously there's sort of analogs here to capitalism are pretty, you know, bang on, where it's like, we've seen what the West will do to places that try to not do capitalism. And this would be what scares me as the Kenneteers, is it's like, even if they beat Charles and they get their sort of more, you know, this is their UBI paradise plan or whatever, like people like London are not going to enjoy this. This reminds me of how when they killed the Alabaster, they got a call from Paris, but Charles didn't get a call for killing the Carmine Beast, right? Like this is... This plan will be more upsetting to London than anything Charles has done.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I guess it's the, you know, the people versus the elites vibe. I think it'll be a rough fight, but they can do it. I believe in them.
I mean, yeah, but I guess it's also just interesting because we see London give power to Charles at the end of this chapter. And so that, like, London is now invested in this region, right? So the Kenneteers sort of taking it back and doing their plan is a bit of an attack on London in a way now. I think London could claim such, I guess. Like, you know, like Canada is a British colony, right? Like it's, you know, the powers of London now sort of are still the monarchy of this region. And so the Kennedys attacking that will, London will be part of that conversation. Like there might have to be some minor war for independence here.
Yeah. Yeah, rough stuff, but I think it'll be fun. I don't, you know, I can see it.
I mean, I can too, but it just like a conversation with London and the Kenneteers is going to have to happen if they want this plan to work, and that's going to be fun.
Yeah. So we're back. We go back to Guillemet, who remains facing Marcy and poses one final challenge to her, which is, you know, is she a hypocrite? basically, is the way I sum it up. Has she truly abandoned the concept of Fae in the old ways, meaning that Guillaume won't be able to predict her, or has she cowardly held on to a shred of her old ways, abandoning her principles enough and being a hypocrite enough that Guillaume can still get her? And it's so good. It's very perfect.
I everything about this section is just executed brilliantly. I love how it kind of opens with it's just the two of them left, like all the Wild Hunt leaves, and it's just one remaining. It's Guillaume. It's become a duel. Like, this is his whole thing. It's a one-on-one duel, and then he even makes a fucking arena in a bit. Like, it's perfect. There are so many tie-ins and callbacks. It's, yeah. And like, this is where it starts to become clear. Like, this section is in Guillaume's head, not Marisica's. Mm. And I love how that was, like, unclear at first, and then it's sort of right here, you're sort of like, oh, this last bit is in Guillaume's head, not Marisica's. Which makes me even more confused about what's going on with the cracked Lucy banner, but whatever.
Mm, yeah. Don't worry about the banner, I think.
Yeah, I'm kind of forcing myself to give up on interpreting what a cracked Lucy banner means at this point. I've been broken and defeated on that front. But I also love how Guillaume is still treating Marisica like a student throughout this whole bit as well. He's so good.
Yeah, he's the winter teacher.
Yeah, he's teaching her a lesson. It's a harsh lesson, but, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so this is great, right? Like, not only is it the stuff about Marcy abandoning her principles, but Guillaume infuses this spear with the failed bargains that Marcy made with Gilkey and Edith, which is, like, very karmically fun. And I really love how this is how Marcy is taken down by her own, like, broken promises and hypocritical principles, which hopefully makes me think we're going to get some similar stuff levied at Charles soon.
Yeah, I want to talk about that where you've got some stuff later in the notes, like Charles specifically. But yeah, I agree. Like, the tie-in to Edith and Gilkey is so good because, like, Guillaume challenges her on them and she's like, oh, I haven't lied, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I don't even care. Like, that's not the point. The point is, did you uphold the spirit of the agreement? And I think it's so funny that a Fae is challenging another Fae on that. But, like, Guillaume getting to do it to Marcy feels right. Because it's like, yeah, like it's the Gilkey poison, which if she'd started doing what she said, wouldn't kill her. If Edith was still around and she'd kept her promises there, she'd be able to see the spear. Like, he ties it in karmically, and like I think Lucy would love this because it's, yeah, she didn't technically break the rules, but she was against the spirit, and that's just so good. And then I think my favorite, the third one, that kind of he doesn't call out directly, but like, obviously the thing he challenges her on here is, as you said, like, there is still a bit of Fae inside Marisica that she's held on to, and he will only be able to predict her movements if that part of her is still in there. And what's fun is she's kind of lied to herself about not being a Fae anymore. She loves to talk about how she's a goddess, not a Fae. So she's, like, lied to herself a little bit about this. And earlier in the chapter, she calls this out as a strength. Like, when the Wild Hunt, when she's going to box the Wild Hunt in with her, her whole thing is she's like, this will be a draw. And it's like, it will take you hundreds of years to get through to me because of the lies I can tell myself. And she presents the fact that she can lie to herself about herself as a strength. And Guillaume turns that on her as well and is like, no, you've lied to yourself about not being a Fae anymore, and that's going to bite you in the ass too. And then, yeah, like, all these threads come in as well. Like, we already touched on Guillaume's messenger from the night the Carmine Beast died. Like, I remember that being a big thing. The Kenneteers investigated in, like, Arc 2. But then also Guillaume's letter that Daniel took gets called out. Obviously, he constructs the arena. Marcy dodging the spear was a point. Like, it's just all these seeds Wildbow planted in, like, the first three arcs of the story come full circle here, and it feels so satisfying that all these threads have just converged and led to Marcy getting the shit stabbed out of her. It's great.
Yeah. It is very good seeing Marcy getting taken down. I found it very cathartic.
Yeah. But this is probably the point where I want to talk about that other thing that comes up a lot in this chapter, which is, like, because you know, all these Fae threads for Marcy and Guillaume are causing, and it kind of feels like this is a bit of a series wrap on Guillaume and Marisica. Like,
yes, it definitely feels Marisica. Like a series wrap on Marcy. That's for sure.
Guillaume's final words are sort of like, yeah, I'm outie.
Yes.
But like, as much as we're kind of closing off all these Fey threads, a huge crux of Guillaume's argument here is that Marisica keeps creating these neat endings for stories, and that's not how stories work. So like, like Marisica talks about how she was able to manipulate Guillaume because he only had a few stories, and so she could condense down all the threads and find the solution. And then it was the same with the Wild Hunt and the consort. She like thought she'd won because she deduced all the possibilities, brought them to a single focal point that was her ending, and like achieved her goal, and then that was the ending of the story. And then Guillaume kills her after that, because Guillaume's whole thing is like, no, just because there was this idea of the story ended, like the story actually keeps going. And of course it's the Winterfey making this thing, because his story is quote unquote ended, but it's still going, right? Like Guillaume is dead because he can't create new stories, but his old story is still being told. And it's hard not to read that as like a bit of a meta commentary on Pale, right? A story that, you know, has had a very interesting relationship with the concept of ending. Because I think we talked about it last week, but I think everyone's been talking about it for years. Like Pale doesn't feel like a story which is going to end and that will be the end. Everything's hunky-dory, especially with what happens in this chapter. So I think this chapter is actually really trying to ram home the idea that like this concept of treating the story like Marisica, where you expect all the threads to eventually wind together and close, and that's the ending. That's not what Pale or the Otherverse is. This is a story that keeps going and isn't going to end. And like Pale will end. Pale's story will end, but that's like, it's not going to feel like, and that's all the threads tied up, tick, like we're done. So I think the story is going out of its way to maybe hint to us, don't expect Pale to just end and that like to feel satisfying in the way that all the threads have closed.
Yeah, interesting.
And like, and Blankshanks brings this up too. Like Blankshanks has his thing where he's like, you know, why would you have a problem? Why would you bring in a solution that fixes your problem if it's not going to introduce more, right? Like this is that fairy thing. Fairy stories don't end. Like, yeah, a dead fairy is a fairy of winter who isn't telling new stories, but is still telling stories. And yeah, like I think it's really fun that I think this is what Pale is trying to hint to us.
I feel like the story isn't going to resolve every single thread, right? I think we kind of know that like there's bits that are being set up almost explicitly for future things. And I read the move away from the Fey courts as one such example.
100%.
You know, I will very happily look forward to the day Charles gets fucked.
Oh, because Marcy's story kind of ends here, right? You know.
At least takes a 300-year hiatus.
Just like the break between summer break and Arc 14 that we didn't get. I'm just sort of raising the point. Like, I think the story, and of course this is that Pale thing too, where it's kind of a meta commentary on itself. This is just a bit of a thing where it's like the way stories work in this universe, we should just be prepared for the fact that we might sort of get resolution to things like the Kenneteer's arcs or whatever, but like don't expect that it's just going to feel like a happily ever after. Like I'm thinking of certain parahuman stories, which have had endings which seeded potential future story ideas, but were endings. And I don't think we should maybe expect the same from Pale. And I think this chapter is trying to tell us that metatextually.
We'll have to see, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just a quick shout out to Mirthstrike in chat, who is predicting that 24.1 will start with a line 300 years later.
That would be wild.
That'd be hilarious. But yeah, Marisica the hypocrite has been struck down by her own cowardice, locked in a box poisoned for 300 years. Yay.
Yeah. And again, at this point, I think Rook is still sitting off to the side watching. So watching someone get put in a box for a long time feels like Rook's cup of tea, I guess.
Yeah, raising a glass to Guillaume. Well done. Lock him in a box for 300 years.
Yeah, love your work. I don't know how I feel about what happens to Marcy here. I'm not a fan. It seems unnecessarily harsh.
I don't know. She defined the parameters, you know what I mean? Like, she was the one who was like, I'm going to build this box that will lock people inside for 300 years.
Yeah.
I mean, she very much hoisted herself on her own petard.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, this ending checks all the boxes for like dramatic satisfaction. Like, you know, she played stupid games and she won a very stupid prize, right? Yeah. Like, but it's, I don't know, in that worst kind of Winter Wild Hunt, like punitive justice, like the focus is she's going to slowly get transformed in this box for 300 years. And when she comes out, she's going to have been twisted into a very different person. And that's like, this is that worst kind of punitive, just, it's not restorative. Like, and don't get me wrong, it's kind of like, we didn't have any other options for stopping Marcy. So I think this is still better than letting her do her thing. Mm. But like, I guess it just sucks that it had to be Winter that sorted this out, because Guillaume's done it in a way that I don't really approve of. Like, I'll take this over not stopping her, but it would have been better if somebody locked her up in Kennet Found and made her go through like lessons like Anthem had to, right? Like,
yeah, but it's like, you know, she explicitly, she was the one who built the lock people in a box for 300 years box. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's, I don't think,
yeah,
it's,
but that's like,
deciding that that's what is going to happen. It's,
I mean, but she, so decided. Do you support the death penalty for serial killers? Like,
well, I know, because the serial killers aren't the one who designed the death penalty. You know what I mean? Whoever invented the death penalty, if they commit crime, if somebody says, hey, I think people who do this should be put to death and I'm going to invent the penalty to allow that to happen, then, you know, I do kind of support the them getting a taste of their own medicine. Like, it's, there is a level of the hypocrisy required to judge people for things that you are doing that makes me think, if you believe that, then we'll treat you the way you want to be treated. You know what I mean?
It's like I do, honestly, because I'm not fully against that. Like, I do agree that it's like, I'm more willing to put someone to the death penalty who is like, say, killed 100 people in an electric chair. Like, but I still think in an ideal world, it would have been nice to fix Mariska, because she, there's a lot to like, as I don't disagree with a lot of her Faye plan. Like, there was a lot to like about Mariska, and like, you kind of had to squander what was good about her to get rid of the bad. But that's the thing, we're not even getting rid of the bad, she's going to come out of it twisted and even worse. Like, I think that's what really loses this for me. Like, it is very much just punitive and twisted, and I don't, it's kind of lowering yourself to her level to use her tools like that. And it's like, Again, I'm not fully against it, because, as you said, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, and like, there weren't any better options. It's just a shame there weren't better options.
I'm very comfortable if people say, you know, if people ask to be treated in a certain way and it doesn't hurt anybody to treat them in that way, then go for it. And Marisica says, the way I interact with the world is by treating people who do X thing by locking them in a box for 300 years. And if that's the world that she wants to live within, she can, you know?
I mean, I don't get me wrong, because I think we've talked about this, but like, in maybe this podcast or another one, but like, that's something I've had to stop doing a little bit, because I grew up, you know, in a Christian household, and there was that whole thing like, treat others as you wish to be treated.
Mm.
And I kind of took that inversely. So I always treated people as how I perceived them treating me. So like, if somebody didn't respect me, I would be rude to them back.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of reactively did that, which is not the intended interpretation of that passage, I think. Mm. But like, so I still very much act like that. Like, if I think somebody is a dickhead, I will be a dickhead back to them, and I feel fine about that. There was a big argument in our house about this recently, actually. But anyway, so I don't disagree with you, but I think there's like a line where it's like, okay, I don't, like, doing something like this to Mariska, I think, is still too far.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I find it very cathartic.
I mean, yeah, it is, but you shouldn't feel good about it. This is the same thing as Avery, right? It's like, yeah, killing the family man, don't disagree with it, but don't feel happy about the fact that you had to do it.
Yeah, see, to me, that's, I guess I'm kind of in a similar place. The karmic, I guess where I'm at is, I believe in the karmic justice. You know what I mean? Like, the way that they cursed the family man prior was the karmic justice to me. It was treating you with an inverted way that you've treated other people, you know what I mean? And I'm very much a firm believer in that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and like, again, I am to an extent, but like also at a certain point, it's like, if we want things to get better, don't we want to try and fix people? Hmm. And in this case, probably not possible. So I'm not totally against what he did here, but I don't know.
Mm.
I don't, yeah. God, maybe this should have been our discussion question.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, is Marisica's punishment just? Mm. I also wanted to call it, I did feel a little bit bad. There's the point, I think, after Marisica's box gets taken away by fairies, Brizaban drops to his knees and is mourning. And I guess we saw how much his death affected Marisica. I did feel kind of bad for the guy here. Yeah. Even though I probably shouldn't, because he's a fae who's doing fae shit. He probably doesn't deserve any sympathy, but he got it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Sympathy for Brizaban.
yeah, and this is where Guillaume seemingly says goodbye to the story, because he's going to head to Winter and get to work on setting it up to maybe be a bit of an archive of the old ways, which I guess are worth preserving.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Well done, Guillaume. See you later. Have a good time on your journey of self-discovery.
Yeah.
And then this chapter ends with Charles receiving a phone call.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much to talk about from this tiny section, but I love the bit where Charles goes and meets up with kind of all of his remaining allies, because as he lists them out, I think it's really interesting to note he's the only one from the OG culprits left. We've lost Marisica. We've lost Edith. We've lost the girl by candlelight. We've lost Liz. Kind of. I mean, Liz is alive, but she's not with him anymore. He, you know, talking about the, you know, ever eroding mapping of culprits to Kenneteers. We've only got our Lucy Lucy culprit fighting till the very end.
Is he the Lucy culprit?
Hasn't he been
mirrored to Verona a lot in this story, Elliot?
Not in the way, like, his fundamental flaw. Like, he was the Lucy. But, okay. I mean, as you're pointing out, like, yeah, the mapping of one-to-one has been eroded, and I think there's a lot to talk about with him and Verona. And, I mean, same, right? Like, Marcy in this chapter, before she seemingly mapped a lot to Verona, whereas now that we learn it was all part of a game she was playing with her brother and stuff to upheave things. I think there's a lot to compare Lucy and Marisica out of this chapter now. Like the whole, you know, loyalty to your brother, working with your brother, all that stuff. I think, yeah, like Wobbo's not letting it be just as simple as one-to-one mappings. But I think what made the connection between Lucy and Charles early in the story was that Charles was the resentment at the world and the anger that had festered part of Lucy that was the bullet she dodged and he didn't. And it was like that they both had that focus on the mission and like changing the system and justice, and that's meant he's the only one left. And I think that's where the Lucy comparison holds.
Yeah, fair enough, I suppose.
Yeah. Also, the Allaire Forsworn get a lot of appearances in this chapter, which really jumped out to me, because we haven't fucking heard of those guys in ages. And like Marisica makes a big point out of them being around her. And then Charles specifically calls them out as a group in this end bit. I don't really have anything here. It's just like, it just jumped out to me. I think we're going to see the Allaire Forsworn do something soon, because it felt weird to me how they just suddenly are relevant. I don't know how or why. Their whole thing was that they were made to just be used, and now they're on Team Charles, which is Team Use People. So it'll be interesting to see how, but yeah, the Allaire Forsworn, I feel like we're leading up to something with them, and I don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah, God knows. They feel like they've been, yeah, very intentionally reintroduced.
Yeah. Also, RIP the Blue Heron.
It was, yeah, not the, had a good run.
Not the worst place in the end. Had its problems.
Yeah. See you later. but yeah, I mean, so Charles has made the deal with the powers that be, a pretty hypocritical move in exchange for power. You know, what a loser.
So I'm gonna come out swinging in my old pro Charles stance here.
No way.
I'm gonna get tinfoil. I I trust my boy. I mean, I feel like a trap the fandom has fallen into a bunch of times, and I remember feeling pretty good about myself when Arc 17 ended, because people kept saying Charles wasn't doing anything and he was a failure, and then it turns out he'd been cooking something behind the scenes. And I think that's happening again. I think this is part of a move Charles is making that we don't fully understand. And the big reason I think that is, there's a line in this section where
he says he won't forswear them, but it's not over yet or something, right?
Oh, I mean, yeah, there's that, but that could just be talking about stamping out, like, Kennet. I really wanted to call out the line where he, as he's sitting in Alexander's domain getting this phone call, he thinks to himself, Alexander, who'd put so much emphasis on forging connections, tying the community together. He'd done many things wrong, but he'd had some good ideas. And like, my immediate thought to reading that line was, first of all, like, how dare you, of all people, say that? But like, I just haven't been able to get that light out of my head, because it's just like, Walbo does not give Charles many words here. And that's like one of the big ones. I'm just like, it's, maybe I am tinfoiling too much, but I think this arc is being go for the throat. And we've seen how Mariska and the Kenneteers are doing that. And I think, Charles is cooking something here. I don't know exactly what, but I think the way he assembles with all his allies and shares that look with the Aurum, I think he's using this power for something more than what we've been seeing him actively doing. And I trust my boy. He needed this power to pull off some plan. I think maybe we're going to get to see him have a fun interaction with the Kenneteers in the wake of it. But I could be wrong, but I think Charles is about to drop another bombshell on us that we didn't see coming. And he's done it before. I trust my boy. He's always ended up having more of a plan than we thought.
So you think he's going to make some anti-Paris play?
Or London, right?
Well, isn't it Paris?
No. Paris was the one who called the Kenneteers in Arc 21.
There was an edit. Okay. My prediction that has been that I've pulled out this week is not going to make sense now post edit.
Okay. Oh, well. Yeah, because when I read it, it was definitely London. And because Seth last week was like, London will be calling.
Yes.
In
yes.
5 minutes.
Okay. So it was a mistake. That's all good. We'll get to that when I get to my prediction then.
Yeah, but so I don't, I trust Charles. He's never let me down before in this way. I think we're going to get to see Charles make a really fun move that's the next stage of his quote unquote plan.
Yeah. Looking forward to finding out, I suppose. Well, let's get into our predictions. I've alluded to my prediction already. It was a prediction from I'm Easily Impressed, who talked about how it was interesting that Paris was the one who called Charles, and that was leading to something bigger. Whoops, never mind. Sorry, I'm Easily Impressed. Deconfirmed.
Yeah, we'll have to take a point off for this this prediction, whoops. Unfortunately.
I thought it was such a good prediction because I kind of didn't even clock it when I read it, but I remembered it was Paris who called, even though Seth had said it was London.
I'm not gonna lie, I read the first line of that thing and was like, no, it was London. I read this like 2 days ago. What are you talking about? Anyway, I've pulled out a prediction from Ponage Hobo, who is predicting that Nora will be made aware just in time to see Avery pull the trigger on killing someone else. They specifically call out Chuck, and link that to the idea that each Kenneteer has kind of deliberately killed someone with assistance from the other two. So, like, Lucy was the one who shot the Alabaster, Verona suffocated the family man, and so the third beat will be Avery killing Charles. And I don't know about the Charles part, but I do love the idea of, like, we're about to enact this awareness pyramid scheme, and Nora will obviously be a part of that. Like, the whole idea of Avery's relationship with Nora as an unaware person has been a whole thing. And, like, if they're doing this, Nora will be a part of it. So I love the idea of putting some kind of spin or twist on it, so it's not just Nora becoming aware and hanging out with Avery, like doing something like Nora seeing Avery kill someone right after she gets made aware. It's some fun extra drama.
Very interesting. But I don't think we're going to see Charles get killed is my problem with this.
Yes. Well, that's I don't agree with Pony Chobo on the Charles part, but I do love the idea of scarring Nora in some way as she gets made aware.
That would be very rough and funny. Good predictions, folks. Thank you for leaving your predictions in our Pale Predictor form. Apologies to I'm Easily Impressed, who has been quickly deconfirmed. Should we talk about our discussion question from this week, Elliot?
Yeah. So we asked everyone which boundary spirit they would like to host in honor of our new power couple, Dorian and Fluorescence.
Mm.
Should we just start working our way through them?
Mm. Yeah, let's do it. Who's do we want to pull out? I liked Bavarian Barbarian, who does a lot of tensile testing at their work so they would vibe with Long, which is, I mean, like a straight and clean match. I think it's perfect.
Yeah. I think they also said they're tall and skinny, so like they're also mm-hmm. like they start off as a good fit for Long.
They're a real lanky Kong looking motherfucker.
Apparently. They talked about being a discount Vista from Parahumans in combat, which I like.
Yeah.
I think there was somebody else who mentioned Long. I should have organized these. Words on the Wind.
Mm.
Vibes with Scatters, but also wants to try Long. We had quite a few people who sort of said which one they think they would be paired with and which one they want.
Mm.
And Words on the Wind was one of those people. Hobo Demon also said Engine Head or Long would usually be their picks, but they were saying they're actually quite ill as they were writing this discussion question answer. And so they changed their answer to Nier, which was that spirit who is like that feeling of being perturbed or like, I don't know, uncomfortable. And specifically, I wanted to quote this, and I'll see how I go reading it out loud. I would use Nier like a blue counter magic deck. Area territory effects, Nier. Niao, that's neutral ground. Ordinary family field, Nier. You'll never understand me. We yell around Nio's rings as our Nyek tattoos shock the suburb serenity with punk energy.
Yep.
So sorry, Hobo Demon. I did my best to get all those Nyes you put in those words out, but I enjoyed that answer a lot.
Sengachi gives us two answers, which give us some interesting insight into them as a person. First up, they bruise easily, so blush stroke might work pretty well, which I think is a very normal answer. This discussion question answer honestly could have ended there. But then Sengachi says something that I think is crazy. You kind of just copy-pasted it without further commentary, but I'll read it out as well, I guess. But I want legs. Like, this is already a daily fantasy of mine. The thought of being stuck behind people in a doorway and then suddenly sprouting tons of pointy legs and using them to scuttle up the ceiling and through the open space in a door. Sengachi gives the impression that they talk about that. Think about growing lots of spider legs a lot, which I just kind of read that and was like, sorry.
The fuck are you talking about?
What?
Yeah. What? No, Ruben, there's a reason I just included
thing in the world.
I included that sentence word for word because I had the same reaction. I read that and I was like, Sengachi, what the fuck are you talking about? That's crazy.
Like, you know, it's like, you know how
apparently we're the weird ones.
Of the void. Everyone also feels the call of the many legs. I don't know what the fuck. Anyway, it was very funny. Well,
everyone in the chat is agreeing with Sengachi, so apparently we're the weird ones here.
What is it? Jesus. Anyway.
I think we also got blush stroke from Immediate Parfait number 91.
Yes.
Who said, blush stroke or dish. They said they're like envy and they kind of want the physical changes you get from those. So blush stroke can do some cool stuff to color your skin and like enhance tattoos, which does sound awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then dish kind of has those like keep shit tidy vibes. And also like, you can have nice tea with dish. So they just both had cool vibes that would enhance the envy thing Immediate Parfait was going for, which I love.
Mm.
They did say Fluorescence would have been on their list, but they didn't want to separate Fluorescence from Dorian, which I think is valid.
That's nice. Yeah, we got Captain Rhino, who picked Footspur just to prevent, or I guess gain immunity to stepping on things, which I don't know if that's how it would work, Captain Rhino. I feel like it would be the opposite.
I had the same thought. I was like, I think it might be the opposite. I think you constantly feel like you're stepping on Legos.
But that empowers you with some, you know, ability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else did we get? Jarlzal was another legs person. They specifically called out that the two sports they play are, like, well, I guess, is running a sports? I don't know. But they do running, and they play underwater hockey, and both of those require, like, a lot of leg power.
Mm.
So legs would be a good fit for them. And then also maybe Borador, because they can be a bit of a lurker who sort of sits between groups at times. And honorable mention to Grabsy, again, because of the running, and also apparently they had a bit of a klepto period as a kid.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough.
Sorry, I just want to, have you ever played underwater hockey? That shit's crazy.
No, what is it?
Well, I mean, it's in the name. It's hockey, but underwater, but so the puck, like, sinks.
Yeah. Oh.
So you've got to, like, you're like doing like free diving, like you got to dive down and like use it. So it's the... like, yeah. Weird. So you hit the puck, and it's pretty short sticks. Like, they're very short hockey sticks, but like, it introduces this fun extra element, because like the movement's harder because you're in the water, but you've also got a time coming up for your breaths. Like,
yeah,
because the water's deep enough that you can't touch the puck and be on the surface of the water.
Interesting.
We played it a bit in PE at school, and it's fun, but intense.
Wow. It seems very strange, but all right, why not? Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting accused of having wild childhood stories in the chat. And I need to, this probably isn't the venue for this, but I'm doing it here anyway. Ruben and I had a disagreement the other night, and I need people on my side. Who here has heard of the game Poo Sticks? / who has played Poo Sticks? Because...
Uh-oh, Elliot. Uh-oh. Oh,
come on.
Looks like your experiences aren't as universal as you thought.
No, this is a normal thing. Because I asked my sisters, and they both agree that poo sticks is normal.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Bellictile's got my back.
You got one out of about 15. Huh? What? No. What? No, thanks. No. Huh?
Okay. Fine. Well, I'm going to introduce you, Kipos, and Penny to Poo Sticks when we're in Hawaii, and
we'll honest, have a great time. I mean, it sounds fine. It doesn't sound like the most fun game.
Well, you just got to get into it.
Yeah.
Sure. But also, okay, sorry, these guys were also claiming it's weird to have, like, raced, like, cockroaches and frogs and crabs and yabbies. Like, it's also normal to, like, race animals as a kid, right?
Well,
come on, chat. You got to give me this one.
I guess just you grew up rurally and didn't have anything to do is, I think, the origin story
here. Well, what were you doing if you weren't going, because, like, this is a thing, right? Like, we do this at like school field trips and stuff. Like, everyone had to go and catch a frog, and then you'd race them. Like,
what field trips about learning, Elliot?
No, these were like the non-learning field trips. They were the learning field trips.
We didn't have non-learning field trips as a kid. I never went on field trips that weren't for an explicit learning goal.
I mean, to be clear, like, most of the time, I think this was like more, you know, like the school holiday, not camps you do, but the thing, like, because your parents started to work, so they dump you at like an activity thing that you do during the school holidays.
Multi-sport. Yeah, that's what we did when we were kids.
I can't remember what ours was called. I think it was just called like holiday school or something. But we just go and like catch yabbies and race.
This was
them
put
stuff.
On by the school or? By you know,
it was hosted at the school. I don't know if the school ran it.
Yeah, no, we did things that weren't at. We used to get dropped off at Sydney Uni. They ran like sport camps or whatever.
I think that's like the same vibe, but ours we'd like go to the school dam and catch yabbies.
So yours was really the low effort version of like, we'll just figure out something to occupy these kids.
Well, yeah,
doesn't
or they'd
have any purpose.
Well, there's sometimes we drove to the town that's like 2 hours away because they had like a big kids playground and we get to play there. Or one time we went to the Lamb and Potato Festival an hour or so away, and we left a kid there. That was really funny because the lady running it like freaked out because she left this kid an hour's drive away.
Yeah, I mean, it really just sounds like there wasn't a lot of oversight on these types of school camps, you know.
No, because we went, like, like, it was organized. Like, the lady told us all to go get frogs. Like, we weren't just deciding to go catch frogs.
No, but I mean, I guess organized is a word that I guess applies pretty loosely in this context.
Fine, whatever. I still think it's weird that none of you have played Poo Sticks. I just, that feels like something everyone did as a kid.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, there's like a handful of people. I feel like about 20% of people agreeing with me now. Anyway. Sorry, where were we?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few more. We had a few people put Smolder just because I think Smolder had cool vibes, basically.
Yeah. I mean, Matt chose him, right? Like, yeah. that's a good.
That's an endorsement for
character
sure.
Witness. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was Orbital Oracle picked Smolder. Niklas Sakuro picked Smolder for awesomeness and fluorescence for prettiness. Do we have any more? I think that was...
We got some scatters. Silent Rider likes scatters aesthetic and vibe. Mm. Scatters is that spirit of just like papers being stirred in the wind. Spiritual Finance 91 picked Bowbreak.
It's just a great name, first of all.
This was their like kind of cheaty answer, they said, because basically Bowbreak grants sanctuary, but something that's called out in the extra material that we'd forgotten about is there's like a tumor attached to Bowbreak that like tries to break any sanctuaries it creates. So Spiritual Finance 91 was basically thinking what they could try and do is like cultivate that tumor like the Doom and like use Bowbreak to create sanctuaries, and then when their enemies are in the sanctuaries, use the tumor to break them. And that's technically allowed because it's all part of how the spirit works. So that's their evil villain plan, basically.
Yeah, fair enough. Good. I mean, I don't know. Anytime somebody in our discussion question answers comes up with a way to try and cheat the system, like, good luck to them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. We also had a few miscounts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some miscounts. Fancy Swamp also said Nyet and miscount, and Drake Blood said miscount because they're forgetful.
Yeah. Propaganda Pagoda said Blush Stroke would be a good fit for them, but they also wanted Unveiled Skullbone, which Unveiled Skullbone, it's right there in the name. It's the spirit of like bone poking out of flesh, particularly skulls. And Propaganda Pagoda's logic was that they thought the body horror stuff sounded pretty cool, and they're like a tall person anyway who's already kind of intimidating, so they think they could handle it better than most other people. And they started talking about the Circle of Life, and I don't get what they're going for at all, but if it works for you, like, I'm happy for you, Propaganda Pagoda.
Yeah, yeah. You did the work, Elliot, to figure out who didn't get picked. Yes.
Yeah, so the thing I did after tallying up all these answers is I went through to find out which spirits lost this, and there was only one spirit out of the 16 that didn't get a single volunteer to host him, and that is Lot, who we might all remember is the angry drug dealer guy. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
so he was like, anyway, literally the only one who didn't get a mention. Basically everybody got at least one person saying they'd be able to vibe with them, except for Lot. So loser.
Whoops. But yeah, thank you everyone for leaving your discussion question answers. Of course, we have a new discussion question this week.
Yeah, did we want to do something about Marcy? No, it's fine. We'll use this discussion question.
Fuck
but,
Marcy.
If you feel strongly for or against Marcy stuff, feel free to comment about that too, and I'll argue with you in the Reddit comments.
But our actual legal discussion question is, what's the closest you've come to an encounter with another or becoming aware? Which we talked about a week or two ago, and we want to hear your stories.
Yeah, we're talking about this, and I think it was Wabo who suggested that we do it as a discussion question, and we like that idea. So tell us the story of the time you almost got embroiled in the seedy magical underbelly of reality.
Yeah, so... looking forward to reading those. I think ghost stories are always very fun. So, leave your other stories in the discussion thread, which you'll find linked in the show notes down below.
Yes. We're also, I'm just going to say it, we're not doing a back-to-pack today because we're recording our reflecting episode right after this. And so we will talk about all the back-to-pack stuff people are probably expecting in that reflecting episode. You will be able to find out exactly when that reflecting episode is coming out by heading to our Twitter, where we post all sorts of news about stuff like that, as well as memes every day.
Yeah. Every single day we post a new meme, so check that out. If you want to support the Doof Media Network, you can find out more information on the Doof Media Network on its website, doofmedia.com, or go straight to the Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia, where you can support the network and get access to bonus content and all kinds of cool things.
Yes, and don't forget to stop by our Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. We've started All Packed Up 2 stuff again, and we're using the money that we get through that Patreon to fund it, and there's some pretty exciting stuff, and you can help it get even more exciting by supporting us on Patreon.
Yeah, and while you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wildbo's Patreon as well, patreon.com/Wildbo. I hear if you give enough, he will let you host one of the 16 spirits, so make your choice, send him some rewards, and see what happens.
It's like, you know how on eBay you can buy... Or maybe it's Etsy, but you can buy like
shit, yeah.
Yeah, spirits and stuff. Yeah. So
no, you can do it on eBay, and on eBay they have to put disclaimers saying that it's not actually actually have a ghost.
But it's like, but people say they'll like do a ritual and then the spirit will come to you within 24 hours.
Yeah.
So you know, maybe. Maybe Wildbo's already done that for you if you're a patron.
Who knows?
Probably not, but maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, thanks for joining us, folks.
See you for our reflecting episode in a few days.
Bye.